It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Monroe Seto Casper. Did you know that different species of ants have different flavors?
In Denmark, all the ant varieties are actually edible. Not all of them taste good. They vary from species to species. They all have a unique, distinct flavor. Some of them are very citrus-like. We have a variety that tastes like coriander. And there's another variety that tastes sort of explosively like lemongrass.
This man working with those delicious ants in Copenhagen is our guest, René Redzepi. He's chef of the renowned restaurant Noma. Oh, to have been the fly on the wall at that first ant tasting. Redzepi's released a 3-volume set of books titled René Redzepi, A Work in Progress, Recipes, Journal, Snapshots. Well, stay with us for this and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Eating local is a whole other adventure in the hands of René Redzepi. His restaurant, Noma, is in Copenhagen. Redzepi turned fine dining there on its ear when instead of the usual French dishes with local fish, he dug deep into what is truly local, but forgotten for generations. Wild plants like reindeer moss turned into a crisp fantasy of a dish, birch bark fluffed into meringues, rutabaga romanced by genius. Well, Redzepi's released a 3-volume set of books titled René Redzepi, A Work in Progress, Recipes, Journal, Snapshots. Rebecca Shear talked with René in the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C.
René Redzepi, thank you so much for taking the time to come on The Splendid Table today.
Thank you.
So as part of this 3-volume book, you have a journal.
Yeah.
Why is the journal part of this cookbook?
Well, I think actually the journal is sort of the heart of the cookbook. First of all, there was never meant to be a 3-volume book called A Work in Progress. I was writing this journal for myself to understand more about our restaurant. But then my editor read it and she really liked it. And then I sent it to some other people and they really liked it. And then at first we thought, should it just be a book, a reading book? But since I'm a cook, I thought that there should be recipes in there too.
Well, in your journal, you keep going back to the idea of creativity, cracking the nut of creativity, figuring out where it comes from, how we can get more of it. What did your journal help you figure out on that front?
Well, I could only see it after I'd written the journal. And so in between all those maniac hours and all the ingredients, the pressure, the accolades, the interviews, everything, I put in between all of these layers something that I didn't think was important in kitchen, something that I had been taught wasn't important, and that was fun. So fun and playfulness, having that be part of your kitchen, a professional kitchen, has turned out to be one of the biggest success factors for us at the restaurant. And the past 3 years have been built on that.
What do you mean fun? How do you have fun in that kitchen when there is so much going on?
Of course. I mean, yeah, we're still a kitchen. We work from morning to night. The pressure's on. We have lunch. We have dinner, 40 diners each time. And they're sort of waiting for that magic to happen. So simple things matters, like changing the opening hours. Now, that will take away that double seating that you could do on 2 or 3 of the tables. We changed our opening hours from 6 to 7 so that we could sit down and eat for an hour and a half, the 3-course meal. And I closed our banquet room. Banquets are, you know, extremely lucrative but horrible in terms of fun. They're simply not fun. So I changed it and built a staff canteen and a library for the staff and a little espresso corner. And then one of the big impacts in our kitchen, I put in music into our kitchens, which was also something that was a huge hurdle to me, like a huge psychological barrier, because I'd always been told music doesn't belong. That sort of conviviality and good life in a kitchen, nuh-uh, you know, don't do that. And so it was a real sort of a moment for me when I put in the speakers to the ceiling and I put remote controls throughout the kitchens. And that did a huge difference. It's just amazing. And then you work with yourself a bit. Try to be cool, you know, be concentrated, focused, and deliver the messages you need to deliver in the best possible way. Don't freak out. Don't be angry. Nothing good comes out of that. You know, I do still get angry, but nowhere like before. And once I stopped doing that, it's just it really positively changed our restaurant and the food.
How would you say it changed the food?
Well, first of all, we have ingredients that come in every day, hundreds of varieties of stuff. And sometimes it's difficult to understand, but say watercress. You have it in 1 week and you do this new dish and you write a recipe for it and it's really good. The watercress is spicy. Then it rains 2 days later. The watercress is not so spicy. And then it's the cook there at the section cooking that dish that sort of needs to make the adjustment so that the magic can happen again in the flavor. Now, if people are in an environment where they're sort of afraid of making decisions or making mistakes or speaking up, those decisions aren't made. They simply just follow the recipe. They become robotic. So our kitchen became less robotic, leaving more space for the individual. And because of that, the food tastes better.
I have to talk about the cookbook, which mm-hmm. has these stunning photos. It's mm-hmm. organized by month to go along with the dishes mentioned in the journal. But the ingredients and the preparations are often, how shall we say, very specialized in yeah. this cookbook. So do you really expect normal, everyday cooks to prepare most of these dishes?
Well, I would say if you are in your kitchen next Tuesday evening and you just picked up your kids and you want to do spaghetti bolognese, then you don't say, but let me just check what the Noma book has to offer. Although, are you on, say, the farmer's market on a Friday, you think, tomorrow, Saturday, I want to spend the day in the kitchen, have fun with that, drink lots of wine at the same time, and cook for my friends. Then there are plenty of recipes you can do that with. The first book we did, the previous one, which is 3 years old, that was a different story. But in the past 3 years, we've become more confident, and as a result, the food has become more simple. So, for instance, there's a recipe which is essentially just a roasted cauliflower. And then it's served with a dollop of whipped cream. Everybody can do that.
But then, for example, the dessert that has... Is it a dessert that has the creme fraiche with the ants on top?
No, that's not a dessert. Well, ants are everywhere, so I don't want to... You know, that one is easy enough. The only question is whether you get the right ants or what. Yeah, there's a... We do this thing. This was the first time we ever started implementing these very delicious, spicy, wonderfully citrusy ants on the menu. And it was sort of a bouquet of aromatic herbs. And in between were like crisped up kale and all sorts of leaves. It was like a bouquet of flowers. And then to go with it was a dollop of creme fraiche that was flavored with these ants to give that citrusy lemongrass, coriander-flavored explosion. And it was a huge success.
Now, these are Danish ants you're talking about. So here in America, can we just substitute out with our American varieties?
I mean, I don't want to say something wrong here, but in Denmark, all the ant varieties are actually edible. Not all of them taste good. They vary from species to species. And I would assume it's the same here.
So, Renee, at this point, you may disagree with me because you're so humble, but you're super famous. I mean, everybody knows you, your restaurant. You've got Michelin stars. You've consistently been on the very top of the list of the world's 50 best restaurants. So how do you feel about that fame? What is it like being you?
Oh, you know, I have two kids. You know, I deal with poop explosions. Can you even say that on radio? I don't know. I feel, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote this journal was for that matter, actually. We were such a young restaurant, and overnight, literally, we went from zeros to heroes. And suddenly there was this newfound attention that I'd never tried before. And it started to almost change the decisions I made for the restaurant. And so, you know, in writing this journal, I also sort of came to have a little phrase that works well for me, which is, consider it all a bank loan. You have to give it back. Don't get attached to it. It's not yours to keep. So I try not to focus on it at all. I try to be the best sort of boss, father, husband I can be. And that's the important thing.
Well, Renee, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
Renee Redzepi is chef of Noma and author of A Work in Progress. Rebecca Shear is host of Metro Connection on WAMU in Washington, D.C. Now, Renee left us with a recipe for potato chip and chicken liver. Take a look, splendidtable.org. Anyone who has ever danced in front of a high chair, made odd sounds made by unknown animals, or simply full-on bribed your child with cold, hard cash to simply get down another forkful of food will want to hear this. We're taking on picky eaters today. New York Times columnist Melissa Clark goes to a very reliable source for advice, Katie Workman, mother of two and author of The Mom 100 Cookbook.
Hi, Katie. So great to talk to you today.
Thank you. It's so great to be here with you.
So kids are so inconsistent about what they eat. One minute they love capers, the next minute they don't like anything except for mashed potatoes. I know you have great coping strategies. Tell me, how do I deal with this?
Well, I wish I could list off a wonderful array of reliable solutions, but I can't. But I do have a lot of experience with this, both my own kids who are, you know, they're pretty good eaters on the whole, which, by the way, I think is something that most people should brag about less.
I know. Don't you hate when you hear about other people's kids who eat all kinds of sushi and anchovies and, you know, every single vegetable in the world?
Yeah. Little Tommy loves sea urchin. He can't get enough.
So how do we cope with these little picky eaters? What can we do?
Well, I think that, first of all, you basically have to keep moving forward like a shark. There's no choice. And there are so many ebbs and flows. Every time you think you have something conquered, you know, your kid eats fish, and you think, well, that's done. My kid likes fish now. And then, sure enough, a week later, they're scrunching their nose up at the very same dish. The number one thing, of course, and it's the number one hardest thing, not coincidentally, is to try not to push too hard and to try not to let it show how much you want them to eat that fish or those Brussels sprouts or whatever it is. Because, you know, kids, there are control issues. This is a time of experimentation, and they're trying to do push-pull with you, and as hard as you push is as hard as they'll pull, and vice versa. And, you know, it's not just a control issue, though. It's also, there's an actual sort of genetic feature at play, which I found really interesting when I kind of started to dig into this, because, you know, one does think, like, why are some kids pickier than others? And there's a very interesting fact, which is that we are all born with about 10,000 taste buds. And over the course of time, by the time you reach full adulthood, you only have 3,000 taste buds. The number simply diminishes.
Wow.
So whatever we perceive as pleasantly bitter, kids perceive as extremely bitter because they've got all their little receptors firing away.
And that's why they like bland food, I guess, because if something's a little bit blander, then it's more gentle in their mouths.
Yeah. And even further to that, all of us are born with these two genes, which have this long list of letters and numbers that I can never remember what they are. But one version of this gene is more sensitive to bitterness than the other. And if a person has one or both of these genes in the more sensitive category, that person will be very apt to be more sensitive to bitter taste than someone who has both these genes in the less sensitive category. And, of course, the studies show that a large majority of these kids have at least one of the sensitive genes. So
There's a biological reason.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But then do we outgrow this? Because bitter things can be really good for you. Some of the healthiest foods are bitter.
Most people do outgrow this. And, of course, there's all sorts of cultural things and environmental things at play because, you know, kids who are growing up in Southeast Asia, of course, are being exposed to a whole different, you know, variety of foods than kids who are growing up in the United States of America. So there is a lot to be said for, again, going back to this sort of repetition, the more they're exposed to certain things, the more that they can learn to embrace those flavors.
So is that how we can get our kids to acquire all those acquired tastes?
Right, exactly. It's called an acquired taste for a reason.
And how do you do that? You just keep giving? I mean, your kid doesn't eat broccoli, you know, first time, second time, third time. I mean, how many times do you have to reintroduce a food for them to possibly like it, or at least to, so you know, you've done your best, and maybe they won't ever eat broccoli. But
right. Well, and you know, sidebar on that for a minute. I mean, we all have some foods we just don't like. That's fair, right?
Right.
But the number 10 comes up a lot in terms of how frequently you have to introduce something in order for it to become somewhat familiar. So 10 times seems to be a rule, which sounds a little bit daunting, I think, but it doesn't have to be 10 times over the course of 10 days. It just has to sort of appear. And another thing is, you know, if you are steaming broccoli or boiling broccoli, that's one way to serve broccoli, but maybe you toss it with a little bit of olive oil and salt and roast it at a high heat so that the roasting brings out the natural sugars and caramelizes the natural sugars in the broccoli. And, I mean, in my house, that's the way broccoli goes, like, flying when I make it that way. But a steamed plate of broccoli, not so much.
Now, have you ever successfully gotten your kids who used to hate something to really start liking something just by reintroducing?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, introducing the food again repeatedly and trying to sort of combine flavors that you know your kid already likes. You know, one of the things my sons both really like is the flavor of balsamic vinegar. They love that sweetness. Mm-hmm. So one day I just basically poured a balsamic vinaigrette that I had made over some fish, marinated it for 20 minutes and broiled it, and suddenly fish was okay.
Wow.
Another thing that I love in terms of introducing new food is peer pressure, which is always sort of brought up in a bad way. But if your kid is seated next to a kid that, you know, probably an older kid that they perceive to be super cool, I looked down at my kids at a dinner party a couple of years ago, and they were with a bunch of teenagers, and they were trying to be really cool and really, like, smooth. And all of a sudden, I looked down, and they were scooping up huge spoonfuls of this. It was a butternut squash coconut Thai bisque. I remember it because they were eating it like, oh, yeah, yeah, we eat this all the time, you know?
That's great.
And another thing that I would also stress is really manageable portions. A big slab of fish on somebody's plate is intimidating. So start with something small, you know, a little ramekin of soup, whatever it is. Just don't overwhelm them with a portion size.
Keep it manageable. Thank you so much, Katie. This is great information.
Thanks. It was great to talk to you, Melissa.
Katie Workman is the author of the Mom 100 Cookbook and blog. Melissa Clark is the author of Cook This Now. Well, Katie left us with her Never Fail to Please the Junior Set recipe for macaroni and cheese. And you know where it is, splendidtable.org. Coming up, tricks from Michael Anthony, chef of the Gramercy Tavern, to juice up your home cooking. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The everyday challenge of feeding your family can be downright daunting. Now, if the thought of another night of sautéed chicken breast bores you to tears, you're not alone. The beginning of the new year is a good time to gather up some tricks to bring some life back into our kitchens. Well, we paired up award-winning writer Dory Greenspan with Michael Anthony. He's the chef of one of New York City's most beloved restaurants, the Gramercy Tavern.
Mike, thanks so much for coming in today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Tell me, how do you start thinking about cooking at home?
Well, first of all, I'm a father of three daughters, and so it's a necessity for me like it is for most folks around the country. Just because I wear a white chef's jacket does not make me immune to all of the challenges that any home cook faces, because sure, at the restaurant, we're likely to make a dish with three or four sets of hands and five or six or seven pots and pans. At home, I'm not willing to do that. It's usually me alone and one or two pans because, let's face it, if it takes more time to clean up than it does to actually prepare the meal, not so many folks are going to, you know, make that a regular part of their
That's
lives.
That's actually a great rule of thumb, that it shouldn't take more time to clean up than to actually make what needs to be cleaned up.
Oh, it's a reality of it.
So we need a little help as home cooks. Can you think of three techniques that we need at home? What are the basics?
Sure. Something comes to mind, for example, in the spring chapter, I presented a recipe that is an asparagus salad. And that asparagus salad, it starts in a pan with a drizzle of olive oil and some fresh spears of asparagus that are roasted, browned a little bit. And it is just as easy as any other technique. And quite frankly, maybe even faster and easier.
And a technique that you can use for chicken, for fish, for other vegetables, it's that pan roasting.
Not to mention, most folks at home do have a skillet and, you know, are comfortable cooking with that. And then with a drizzle of olive oil to finish, a squeeze of lemon juice, and then, say, a little shaving of raw asparagus to top it, you can add an herb, another vegetable, or just leave it simply as it is. And in a 15 or 20 minute time period, you have a really complex salad that kind of echoes and layers this idea of asparagus.
You said a squeeze of lemon juice. That little bit of acidity at the end, whether we're cooking pasta or chicken or fish, just that freshness at the end.
You're hitting on something that I think is becoming a defining quality of American cooking. If you look across the country, this use of acidity, whether it comes from a citrus fruit or from vinegar or from products like verjus and any sort of
verjus,
condiment.
The juice from...
Unfermented grape juice. Right. And vermouth, all sorts of... products, if they bring a touch of acidity that make your tongue water, then they add interest. And I think American cooking is all about these highs and lows. French cooking being about harmony, Japanese cooking being about nature. American cooking is about these exciting, liberating, and kind of this freedom of like these highs and lows. A little bit of spice, a little bit of acidity really, I think, starts to define who we are and how we eat.
I love that description of American food. So if we want to hit those highs, are there ingredients that we should have on hand? I know you use an ingredient that I've never used, shiro dashi.
Oh, yeah. That is one that I think is worth mentioning.
And tell me about it. Describe it for me.
Shiro dashi literally translates into white soy sauce. It's a brewed Japanese condiment, similar to soy sauce, but a little smokier, a little saltier. It actually isn't all that widely used throughout Japan, but certainly not in restaurants, but it is used at home. And it's a simple way to bring a great smoky and slightly salty aspect to a dish. And another beautiful way to make a dish pop would be to have a vinegar that you feel connected to. I use rice wine vinegar, but you could sure substitute white wine or champagne or any other vinegar that you really feel connected to. And there's a whole section on making vinegar pickles. They're pickles that I keep in the refrigerator, and they'll hold for months and months and can be included to make dishes exciting.
You have a recipe that fascinates me. It's very, very simple, and you use it in... just going to turn the page here. In the slow-roasted pork shoulder, right? And it's the bacon broth.
Right.
Talk to me about this broth. It's fascinating.
Well, so when I have some scraps of bacon, you know, take an onion, a little piece of carrot, clove of garlic, and an onion, slice it, lightly saute it with those bacony scraps. And you can even do them in advance, and they're wonderful to just warm up. And whether it's used in this recipe, the slow pulled pork, or it's applied to another dish, a vegetable dish, you get to enjoy these smoky flavors, and at the same time, one dish or one meal leads into the next. After all, cooking at home is not really a collection of recipes. It's more like kind of this continual story.
I will be making the slow-roasted pork shoulder. I will be making the bacon broth that's part of it, and I will be finishing it, as you do, with some vinegar to give it some bite. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you, Dory.
Michael Anthony is author of the Gramercy Tavern Cookbook, and Dory Greenspan's latest book is Around My French Table. Now, from Michael, we've got recipes for a leisurely weekend supper. Slow-roasted pork shoulder with bacon broth and cornbread. You're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Food historian Rachel Loudon has a slightly different take on the usual food histories that we read about. She looks at how technology has shaped what we eat now and what we've eaten for the past 20,000 years. She also has some very interesting things to say about the food movements of today. She's written Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. Rachel, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
You know, I always think that every book, especially a book like yours, that's a book about history, has a question that it's trying to answer. What was yours?
Mine was motivated by the realization that we are, as is almost a cliche, the only animal that cooks, the only animal that transforms natural products before we put them in our mouths. And I wanted to tell the story of all these amazing transformations of grapes into wine, of milk into butter, and to see what difference it's made in human history.
Now, the subtitle of the book is Cooking in World History, but the title of the book is Cuisine and Empire. So where does the empire come into the picture?
The empire comes into the picture because today we tend to think of cuisines as national cuisines. It's Italian cuisine, French cuisine, Vietnamese cuisine, Thai cuisine. But of course, nations, even the oldest nations, have only come into existence in the last couple of hundred years. And so for most of history, the political unit that shaped and transmitted cuisines was the empire. And one empire looked at another empire, and if they thought their cuisine was great, they copied it.
And then there was all the trading and the exchanging and the conquering. So there's always been a crossing of cuisines, a sharing of cuisines.
Oh, absolutely. One of the really striking things is that you can tell the story at the grand level, if you imagine yourself flying over the earth and looking down, in terms of great spreads of cuisines, whether it's Buddhist cuisine in the first 1,000 years after AD, mm-hmm. or whether it's Islamic cuisine, or then Catholic cuisine, and more recently, modern Western cuisine.
You've given yourself an interesting span in this book. You start 20,000 years ago with man trying to master grains and get them to be edible. But you bring us to today and you talk about the myths and the romances of food today. What do you mean by that?
That we have become accustomed in the last quarter century to thinking about food in a way that people have never thought about it really before in history. We tend to think that it's been produced in the past by small yeoman farmers, by peasants. We stress the fresh and natural. We downplay cooking, at least in the public pronouncements, because of the emphasis on fresh and natural. We assume that home cooked is the best way to go. And these are very recent kind of ideas.
Really? I mean, I'm thinking the model, at least in a lot of people's minds, is what we've had documented over the past maybe 500, 600, 800 years. A lot of it Western-based, but the idea that people didn't have restaurants, they cooked at home, they ate what they had handy to them, mostly. I don't understand where the myth comes in.
I think the myth comes in because we have a very specific notion of the family meal. Ours assumes that it's mother and father and children seated around a table, which is both the source of physical and of spiritual or social nutrients or nutrition. Consider, for example, Hawaiian society up until the middle of the 19th century. Sure, the food was prepared locally, but women were not allowed to prepare taro. Men and women were not allowed to eat together. If they did, the women were killed.
What? And, they were killed?
Yes, the last person to receive this punishment was in the early 19th century. So, yes, in a certain, I mean, the food was local and it was prepared locally, but it was a long way from our notion of the nurturing family meal.
Well, what about the idea of eating close to the ground?
Yes, obviously, people did have to eat close to the ground, but the trouble is that most of what the ground produces tends to rot, go bad, smell, and it's absolutely essential, since everybody has a season when food is not available, whether it's a wet season or a dry season or a cold season, to preserve food, so that the huge energy of societies went into trying to constantly preserve food so that they could survive through the difficult seasons. People have always put their best thinking, their most ingenious ideas into trying to find new ways to turn plants and animals into something that we believe to be good to eat. And I don't believe we've reached the end of our ingenuity or our cleverness in finding new ways to make food good to, or raw materials good to eat. And we obviously want to continue that.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Rachel Loudon has written Cuisine and Empire. And I have to add, if you have any interest in Hawaiian food, her earlier book, The Food of Paradise, it's a gem.
I love you.
We are talking with you this hour. Connect with us. Just call 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We have got Edward calling from Statesboro, Georgia. Edward, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to ask you a question about a spice. Turmeric, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, you are. You are.
A friend of mine mentioned it to me the other day, and she was told that it was very cleansing for your body, especially for like your liver, but she doesn't know what to do with it, and I didn't know what to tell her. So what would you use that spice for?
Well, it's used a lot in Indian cooking. Mm-hmm. You know the yellow color you see in commercial curry powder?
Yes.
That's from turmeric.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it has a lot of health claims, you know. And again, I'm not a nutritionist, so I can't say yes or no about that. One of the ways to use it is in Indian dishes, you know, and if you check out Indian recipes, you're going to find that it shows up, but it shows up in relatively small quantities because it's quite, it can have a arid taste to it.
Yeah.
You use too much and it's almost like something astringent. It stays with you.
Yeah, and that's not a really good taste.
No, but here's one of the things that's great to do with it. Do you eat meat?
Oh, yes.
Okay, take a chicken, butterfly it, and then take a food processor or mince up on your own some garlic, cilantro or a lot of mint.
I love cilantro.
Yeah, and fresh lime. And then you can add ground coriander if you want or orange zest.
Mm-hmm.
And then stir into that mixture a bit of yogurt or a bit of soft butter, or a little bit of cream, not a lot, and about a teaspoon of turmeric.
Okay.
And you rub that all over the chicken, okay? Stick it in the fridge overnight, and the next day, either slowly grill it, because you're in Georgia, where, well, I know right now the weather isn't so hot, but the reality is you're in Georgia. You guys can grill.
But, you pretty much grill all year round.
Right. Slow grill it and baste it with just a bit more of, you know, either a little bit of butter, a little bit of cream, a little bit of rich yogurt. So
oh,
that you
can, delicious.
Yeah, and you probably want to give it some salt and pepper. And some people throw a little brown sugar into that mix.
Oh, that would be interesting, too.
Wouldn't that be? So try that. That's one way to go. Look at Indian recipes. It's another way to go. You can stir a little bit of it into soups. You can stir it into broths, not too much. And one of the tricks is it makes poor man's saffron rice. Because it tints the rice.
That's a neat trick.
Yeah, it's a neat trick. And by the way, you put it in pasta water, you get golden pasta.
That would be neat.
Just remember, use less than you think.
Okay, because it's really strong.
It really is. Well, when you sniff it, you'll see. You'll see.
Well, thank you so much, and I love the show.
Hey, thank you, and thank you for a great question.
All right, thanks.
Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, we're going to be right back with more of your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. Well, we're back to talk to you. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, send us an email, splendidtable.org. Charlotte is calling from Austin, Texas, one of my favorite cities. Charlotte, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. So I hosted an event recently, and it went really well, but I bought too much food. And I'm left with two huge unopened vegetable platters. And they're just kind of your typical crudité that you get from the grocery store.
Right, right.
So I have broccoli, cauliflower, baby carrots, and celery, all raw and in mass quantities. So what's something fun that I can do with these leftover veggies?
Ooh, well, of course, the first thing I think of is a dynamite vegetable soup and that you would puree.
Oh,
and
okay.
Let's just make a dynamite vegetable soup, but throw in some interesting spices and stuff, okay? All
That's
right.
Great.
You've got two big of those big trays. Mm-hmm. You may need to work with two pots. But by the way, this will freeze, right? And then you can add things to each thing you defrost. Like you can add yogurt and lemon and chopped garlic as a Middle Eastern finish. You know, you could ladle it out, heat it up, and just plop that on the top. And another batch, you could add salsa and, you know, beans that you really love. And another, you see what I'm saying? So we're going to make
Absolutely,
a soup that's good on its own, but can really be a hoot, you know, to play with. Okay, number one, this is what you're going to do. For each tray, you want two large onions.
Okay.
And you want to have about 2 inches, well, 1.5 to 2 inch piece of fresh ginger. And you want about 6 cloves of garlic. And
good.
Right. And then what you want is also a few cloves. Whole cloves. And you want to have some basil and some thyme. And if you want a little bit of dry oregano.
Wow,
not too much.
Really aromatic.
It's going to be really aromatic. And do you like chili? I mean, you live in Austin. You like chili?
Oh, absolutely. Huge fan.
Okay. We're going to be tame to begin with. 1 jalapeno.
Okay.
All right. Now, you're going to chop up those onions. And you're going to take a big pot, you know, like a 6-quart, 8-quart pot. You're going to film the bottom of it with olive oil, heat it over medium heat, and throw in those onions. And if you want to chop up in the food processor some of the carrots and celery from your platter, that could go in too. And what you're making now is called a sofrito. It's a sautéed, flavorful base. And you're going to cook that. And let me tell you, you've got a choice here. This is kind of fun. You can get a robust, meaty flavor from that by cooking it over medium-high heat, stirring so it doesn't burn, but you get the onions browned and the carrots and the celery starting to brown. Or you can put it over low heat and with, you know, the vegetables or without them, just the onions or with the veggies. And you can cook it covered so that the onions throw off a lot of liquid. They get super sweet. You uncover them. You do that for like 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Uncover them and cook off that excess liquid. But you get this super sweet, mellow, luscious flavor. So you take your
wonderful.
Pick. And you could do one batch one way, one batch the other way. Okay. So when the onions and everything is browned, you're going to drop in 6 cloves of minced garlic. So 3 cloves per pot. You're going to throw in the herbs and the cloves. And I would, just for fun, throw in a couple of generous tablespoons of tomato paste in each pot because tomato paste is loaded with umami.
Okay.
And you know the other thing I throw in? I throw in 2 cups of white wine into each pot.
Sure. Why not?
Okay. Because that gives to it. And then you're going to cook that until it really tastes like a fabulous sauce. And then you're going to take all of those veggies, you're going to throw them in the food processor and just pulse. You want to break them up into small pieces. Dump them in there, and now you can either add broth, and yeah, it could come from a can or a box, or you could add broth and water. And you want
to cut. That's great.
Yeah, and what you do is you add enough liquid to obviously cover the vegetables, and the more liquid you add, the thinner it is, the less liquid you add, you know, obviously the thicker it's going to be, and that you can adjust to your taste. And then if you want to, you can also dice up some potato in there because when you puree, that'll give it some more consistency.
Okay.
And you don't have to puree
it. Thanks so much, Lynn. It sounds awesome.
It's going to be.
I can't wait to try it.
Yeah, and the idea. Oh, and I forgot the jalapeno goes in too.
Oh, yeah.
Mince that up. But the idea here is when you get done with that soup, you keep tasting it and you add more of whatever ingredient you want. And now you have soup for the ages.
Exactly. Oh, which is perfect for this weather. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Thanks for a great question, Charlotte.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
We have Georgina on the line from Iowa City, Iowa. Georgina, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You are welcome. What's on your mind?
Well, I am sick to death of the weather. And my friends and I were talking, you know, nobody gives parties in January because we're all so cold and want to stay home all the time. But we really want to get together. Do you have any ideas that we could, things that we could cook that aren't too heavy and stewy, but would be fun for us,
you know,
kind of lift us up.
Yeah, I think, you know, yeah, because January is when I start thinking, yeah, I love my bean stews and all that. But the other side of it is I want to know summer will eventually show up.
Yeah.
You know, this is where I turn to Southeast Asia, to like Vietnamese food and Thai food, because it's so fresh and it's bright. Spring rolls are dynamite. You know, that's where you take the round rice paper discs. They're kind of fragile, but you just dip them in water. You let them soften. And then you can put anything in the center that, like noodles, that are gonna give it a little body. So I just take very thin rice noodles and I soak them in very hot water, get them soft, drain them really well. You want nothing wet. I put that in. Then I will take cabbage and carrot, or just carrot and thin sliced onion. And I do the carrot in the food processor, so I make like shreds. And you know the dipping sauce you use for spring rolls? It's fish sauce and sugar and some...
Right, I was just going to ask you about how to make that.
Yeah, usually you do this. It's one part fish sauce to 2 to 3 parts something acidic, you know, lime juice, lemon juice, or vinegar.
Oh, okay.
And then sugar to taste, which is usually another 3 parts, and garlic. And if you want, ginger and a little heat. And you add a little water to that because the fish sauce otherwise is really funky. But I fool around. I make it to my taste. And I make a jar of it because it'll keep a month in the fridge.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
So what I do is I shred up the carrots, baby cabbage, you know, whatever. I toss that around. I take a paper towel and I get all the moisture out of it. And then I toss it with that dressing. And I let it sit for the day or two or three. And when it comes to make the spring rolls, I take whatever leftovers I've got. So it could be, you know, the barbecued pork, or it may be, I don't know, a piece of tofu or something, a little meat. That can all go in there. And what I do is I take that carrot salad, I drain off everything, put that in, put in some fresh cucumber. And if I've got any fresh mint or coriander, I put a couple of leaves in. And then I roll it up, you know, and you roll it first, just like a jelly roll, but you flip over the sides. It's a circle. So, and you keep rolling and rolling. And you can pile those up. Make single layers, it's easier, on platters, and you cover it with a slightly moistened paper towel and you can stick it in the fridge. I don't make it super far ahead, but you can make them a lot, you know, a fair amount of time ahead. One of the killer things to do is to have the rice noodles, the carrots and whatever, and put slices of avocado with a lot of lime and chili sauce on it.
Right up our alley. What if I didn't make them ahead of time and everybody just rolled their own?
Oh, you could, yeah, you know what? You could take some, you know, takeout chicken, pork, you know, non-meat, whatever it is. You could have a pile of that carrot salad, have the greens, right? You could even put lettuce in it, have the rice noodles. You could put nuts in it. Put out bowls and let everybody roll. I think that would be a hoot.
I think it'll be fun.
I think it'll be great fun. And, you know, bring out a little inexpensive Riesling or my favorite Vino Verde, Pavao, P-A-V-A-O. It's from Portugal. I think at the most it is $7 a bottle.
Great, Lynn. Thank you.
You are welcome.
This will raise us up.
It's going to lift your spirits because summer will come. We know this. Thanks, Georgina, for a great question.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
You can have so much fun. You know, just go to the countries where it's warm and the food tends to be alive and spicy and interesting and a lot of raw fruit and raw vegetables. And that's where I always go to Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, Malaysia, you know, all of that Southeast Asian. I'm a sucker for it. But it is fabulous food when it's the dead of winter and it's kind of you're thumbing your nose at what's going on outside. 800-537-5252. And that's how you can reach us. Nobody does classy soap opera like the British. And Downton Abbey is up there with the best of them. I mean, you've got characters that you love to love or love to hate, wonderfully tangled storylines. I mean, Maggie Smith alone is worth the hour. And, of course, the costumes. But for me, topping it all is the food. Over-the-top edible architecture. Elaborate beyond the beyond. I mean, in the days of Lord and Lady Grantham, dinner was showtime and much of the bling was on the table. So who recreates this grandeur on Downton Abbey down to the last bonbon? Well, it takes the combo of a meticulous chef and food stylist. This is Lisa Heathcote. Her screen creds include The Duchess and Cold Mountain. Lisa, good to have you with us.
Hello.
Now, I'm looking at what you do from the outside, of course. It looks glamorous. This looks like one plum assignment. How do you get to do this kind of thing?
Well, yes, it's a lot less glamorous than you can imagine. I mean, it is food, and I am trained as a cook.
But this is a very different kind of cooking than you would be doing if you were just doing a dinner party. I mean, you've got to have these things look spectacular for... I mean, how long can a scene be shot? How long does that food have to be there looking spectacular?
Well, okay, Downton, for the meals around the table, that could take all day. So I've got to think, okay, the food's got to stand there all day. It's got to look good, it's got to taste good, and it's also got to be something that you want to nibble at all day, because otherwise you're just going to feel not so good after about the third or fourth take, because they're doing, you know, take after take after take.
Right, right.
And also we have the added problem with Downton that the food has to be what's called butler service, so the actors have got to kind of struggle with it themselves off the platter which is presented to them, so it's also got to be user friendly. So it's, you know, I try to do something that has got to be historically accurate, and then I'll kind of give watercress or cucumber or something like that that the actor can actually eat. So it's a bit like running a restaurant. It's like mass catering, because if you imagine there's 20 around the table and we'll refresh the plates every two or three takes, it's like catering for about 80 people.
So that means that very fancy, salmon covered with an aspic.
Yeah.
Will you have a couple of those made ahead so that you can keep slipping
them? More than a couple, a lot.
20 salmon floating around in some place that you hope is cold enough to keep it all from melting.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, there's a good couple of days preparation, and obviously all the food is not made on set. I have a working kitchen that I work from, and then I have to pack everything up, drive it to the set, unpack it, and so there's a lot of work goes in beforehand.
This is very elaborate food, especially the upstairs at the dining table. I mean, this is not a few chops arranged on a platter with a scattering of broccoli. I mean, the food was... It was like making jewelry. It was so exciting.
Yes, I love that you've seen that and you understand that, because actually for me, I think it's a really fun time for food. And it's great to make things look kind of beautiful. And so, you know, it's all highly, highly decorated. You know, it's like making art with food, which I really enjoy.
How much of the food that we see is real and how much of it is... a prop? Well,
we never do prop, because prop food looks like prop food. It doesn't look real. So all the food is real, but maybe the cakes. So if I made a Charlotte Russe, I made one the other day actually, and a Charlotte Russe, I should say, is a very traditional out of the period, and it's a flavoured sort of custard, and then it would be put into a mould with round the edge sponge fingers. And then it had jelly on top with a pattern with aspic and cherries and things. So you make the pattern on the bottom of your mold with the jelly, put your sponge fingers in, and then put the custard and let it set and turn it out. However, if I'm going to do those for sort of downstairs, Mrs. Patmore, or upstairs, I'd probably just use a faux cake, and then actually stick the jelly to the top with a pattern and put the sponge biscuits around the edge so there's no custard in the middle, and tie a ribbon around it, and for all the world it'll look like a Charlotte Russe, but it'll stand there, it won't wilt.
Now, are the actors, I mean, you mentioned that there's watercress on their plate because they are eating in these scenes, and some of the food is sitting there a long time. What are they actually eating?
We do try to refresh the food. So, you know, if it's been sitting there for a while, you know, you kind of take the plate away, clean it off, and reset a new plate. And this last series, we seem to have a lot of salmon mousse somehow. It seems to be scripted a lot. So we don't use real fish because it just gets a little smelly and also not great for the actors. So I've made a lot of cream cheese salmon mousse this season. Which was actually, I say so myself, quite delicious.
so you'd actually take cream cheese, tint it, texture it, etc.
I put gelatin in it and set it in a mold. And if you put cottage cheese in as well, then you get a sort of, it looks like flakes of fish, kind of get this more texture.
Right.
And then lots and lots of lemon juice and maybe some herbs. So it's not just the kind of a mouthful of cream cheese, which after a while is going to get very sickly. And then chill it right down. And it's actually quite fresh. I mean, you know, it's, and so they've got a little bit of Melba toast with it, a little bit of cucumber, you know, all in all, quite tasty.
Are there actors in the crew? This is sort of a behind-the-scenes question,
yeah.
But who are the people who really love food?
Well, I'm sure Hugh won't mind me saying, because he seems to be in a lot of breakfast scenes, and he does enjoy his sausages. So we have had an incident where they changed the scene on one particular day, and I'd ordered my sausages, but of course they weren't ready in time, so I had to go and get some other sausages. And it was noted that they weren't the same sausages. So he said, where's my delicious sausages?
Lisa, I think there's a lot of people right now hearing this who would love your job, and I know it's incredible work, but thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's fun.
Lisa Heathcote is the chef and food stylist who creates all the food that you see on Downton Abbey. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill, who said, I've never developed indigestion after eating my words. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to our website to get information on just about everything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn, at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.